Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And this is the pledge drive edition of Food and Wine with Foreman and Wolf.
It sure is.
All the great programming that goes on WYPR and on National Public Radio is possible from listener support, including this show. Thanks to everyone who's pledged already. If you haven't, we hope you'll call right now, 410-235-1395, or give online at WYPR.org. And Cindy Lou, what do we have on tap this morning?
Well, we're hotly anticipating spring.
Hotly anticipating spring. I think it's 25 degrees outside.
It is, and it's, you know, we might have had some snow. We might have some snow, and then it's going to be 70 degrees for a week. I don't know. Poor plants. I look at my trees and say, I'm so sorry. I don't know what's going on with the planet, but hang in there. Hang in there,
Maryland,
trees, plants.
It's Maryland in March.
Well, but, yeah, okay.
I mean, it's 25 one day, 72 in 2 days or something.
Is this how it was when you were a kid?
Yeah, it's March.
Didn't you have more snow here when you were a kid, though? Or not so much?
People like to tell a lot of stories about what used to be and what, you know, all that kind of stuff. And Lord knows I'm one of them. but no, I mean, I think the blizzard this winter, the 29.78 inches or whatever of snow is the most we ever had in one snowfall.
Oh, for sure. But didn't you just consistently have more snow?
You remember the winters when you
do. I expect you were still kind of in winter in March rather than now where we're a little warmer. Because it wasn't last month the hottest month on record for the planet or something. I mean, I don't pay too close of attention to it, but I believe I read that, which is kind of horrifying. But anyway, on a positive note,
yeah,
it's time to think about spring and think about planting. And I just bought a farm, which has been a dream for me for ever since I started cooking. And so I'm thinking about it. And I wanted to ask you, because your area, you know so much about wine, and I want to really kind of, you know, I think people, it's very helpful to understand what happens in the whole cycle of planting for vineyards, because not only obviously does the land affect, and even an individual patch or acre of land affect how the wine tastes, but of course the weather. So what do you think is going to be happening right now with planting vineyards? And
two things. I mean, the time of the year, the cycle for the plants is always a cycle for the plants. Some things don't change. And this is for vines. This is for if you're going to grow, rutabagas on your farm. If you're going to grow whatever it might be, the cycle doesn't change. Of the earth is on a certain path, the distance to the sun is a certain distance, and the cycles of sunlight are the single biggest thing that affect what's going to happen with whether it's your glass of wine or anything else that you're growing. If you're growing strawberries, if you're growing asparagus, if you're growing anything else. I mean, that's something that over the years you kind of learn. It maybe begins with an interest in wine growing and wine production and the end result, but in the end it comes down to farming, and that is very interesting to watch. And I think that we're in a part of the country where it's kind of tricky. I don't envy a lot of the farmers here that have to figure out when is that last frost actually going to be.
Sure.
And what varieties of X plant are actually going to be resistant to light frost that might come late and all that sort of stuff. There's certain signposts of, like St. Patrick's Day, you rarely think of an actual snow or an actual, you know, after St. Patrick's Day here. You rarely think of, if you're going to plant anything that's remotely delicate, the old adage is you got to wait till May 1st. I know almost no one that waits for that. And a lot of the farmers that grow things for us, for our restaurants and the people see at a lot of the farmers markets, now is a very busy time.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
They've already got things started in hoop houses and getting ready to transfer onto plots of ground come April and sometimes before that. But that depends exactly where they are. What you're talking about with wine and a matter of terroir, which is everything surrounding a growing condition in a certain place, including the weather pattern, it's the same thing for, say, our tomato farmers that we use. We use two in particular that are in very different places. One in eastern Baltimore County in a really warm spot near the water. The soil temperature rises faster. And that distance to the sun I referenced is the same, there as it is in like Western Carroll County, where another farmer is that we buy a lot of tomatoes from, heirloom variety tomatoes, when the season comes. But their season usually comes 3 to 4 weeks later, and they sometimes end up with Indian summer sort of tomatoes that are really superior, whereas the ones that have, that came earlier and that site that comes earlier, those things tend to fade in flavor a little bit later in the season. And the decisions those guys make and when they plant, exactly what they plant, based on soil temperatures and frost and all that kind of business, has everything to do with how that's going to cycle in particular. I just know that for us, you know, 15 years later of working with these two guys, that depending upon how competitive they are or not, and how complementary they are and how they plant and the way the season goes, we're going to have anywhere from 5-6 weeks of superior tomatoes to maybe 8-9 weeks of really spectacular ones.
It makes a huge difference for us in the kitchen.
Yeah. But I mean, I think that's an easy thing for everyone to relate to, is because everyone in Maryland anyway, it seems like, looks forward to
tomatoes coming when the time comes. Definitely.
For wine, it depends on exactly, it's the same thing, exactly what you plant, where you plant, and how you not manipulate the cycle of the vine growth, but how you deal with what happens as the season goes along later in the season. Frost you can't do much about. And you're a little bit more, even more than, let's say, you're planting truck crops like tomatoes or potatoes or carrots or something. You're more subject to what the earth is actually doing. What the farmers who grow wine, the wine growers, are always talking about, it seems like, especially when you talk to them in Europe, is climate change. They are more used to more varied cycles of the growing season than we are used to, let's say, on the West Coast in the U.S., especially in California, where you begin with such a high baseline of amount of sunshine and days of a certain heat index that the dips don't hurt them so much, and they're not used to adapting to the dips. And the spikes, they've already kind of adapted to some extent because of the amount of sun and heat that they deal with on a regular basis anyway. When you get up towards Oregon, or, you know, that's they're more sensitive and a little bit more like the European growers, and you'll hear real climate change talk there. In eastern Washington state, they're growing in a desert anyway.
Yeah, that's,
you know, that's the other great wine growing area. But there, it's an awful lot of manipulation to grow in the first place, even though it's good soils and the sunlight is pretty ideal for a lot of things.
Yeah, it seems like they work hard at what they do there.
It's but
and
yeah,
produce such a great,
it's so dry.
Yeah, and have a great effect, which is wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, they end up with
love
pretty
Washington
good control
state
of what
wise.
They do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, pretty.
Yeah, I have a big fondness for those. We've done some really cool wine dinners with some people.
There's a lot of balance. There's a lot of balance in those Northwest wines that is a little bit different from some of the other stuff that you see in the States.
So is bud break a time that's sort of, is that sort of the pinnacle of, you know, oh, but my goodness, we can't have a frost, we get bud break, we're in trouble?
If you're a wine grower, bud break is when you stop sleeping.
I bet. Yeah.
Because the sap is running, and if you have a big frost, you know, it's funny, when you read the history of things, you go back and read about the vintages with killer frosts.
Oh, gosh.
You know, and the 30s had a bunch of them. Nice to have that go along with the Depression, right?
No, yeah, well, the, difficult time, gosh.
And then the 60s and 70s had some really bad frosts.
And does that kill the entire plant or kill the crop for that year? Or?
It could be both.
Both, yeah. Okay.
Could be, you know, it's one of those up to and including.
Yeah, right.
Termination
Imagine
of the vine.
Imagine that.
Yeah.
And how long does it take for a vine to produce grapes that are wine worthy, basically?
Usually they say third leaf, meaning your third year.
That's a pretty serious investment.
Well, but often they don't produce interesting. You have no idea. The thing is, let's say that you're making a new dish.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to make you buy a fish that you haven't, like the first time you bought trigger fish, let's say, and you broke it down. You found out the first time what your yield was going to be from the fish.
Right.
And then you first time that you started dealing with cooking it, you had to deal with exactly what does it do.
Right.
And then you taste it, and then you have to figure out what the garnishes are and all that kind of stuff. But you know what? Tomorrow someone's going to catch another triggerfish.
Right.
And you'll know better what to do.
Right. That's true. Yeah, of course.
So let's say that you plant Cabernet Sauvignon on some particular hillside. And 3 years in, if it survives those 3 years and you've taken care of it properly, you may have some grapes that can produce some juice that you can then ferment. if you know how to do these things and take care of in the cellar for a long amount of time, you know, maybe let's say up to, let's say a year or so, where you're done with fermentation, malolactic fermentation, that you've aged it in wood a little bit, and you have something that's going to be representative of what it might be to plant Cabernet Sauvignon on that hill. That's a minimum of 4 years to get to where you have your first meaningful, like, glimpse into what might happen.
That's tremendous, really.
It's a little easier to buy that trigger fish tomorrow.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, for sure.
A lot of times, that's one of the things, one of the advantages that a lot of European growers end up having on us in the States is that we're very fast at figuring out how to get things planted and how to get things produced. How to get things to actually give the message of the soil and the place and tell the and be good enough, tuned in enough to give that message and be pleasurable and be balanced for food and to give varying stories based upon what that year was like. That's a bit more nuanced. But that's one of the, and that can be the most intriguing thing about wine in and of itself. But man, it's a long path to get to that place.
Absolutely.
You're talking about, I mean, you know, several hundred years of Pinot Noir being grown in Burgundy to get to something that resembles what we taste as the Pinot Noir that comes out of Burgundy right now. And California, we've actually been faster, but it's just a very different situation.
Well, we've traveled and seen vineyard sites where they're pulling up the old vines, and you just know those vines were there for a long time. And you just know that has to be sort of a fearful, you know, it's a leap of faith to replant that vineyard. Maybe they're putting in a new type of vine into those vineyards.
Old vines a little bit. I mean, I have affection for old vines, but there's also an economic. Old vines have a characteristic that their production as they age, and sometimes it's after 35 years, sometimes it's after 40, 50. You know, there are 100-year-old Zinfandel vines in certain places in California, or there are 200-year-old Abrino vines on a sandy seacoast.
200-year-old.
Of Spain, you know.
That's amazing.
Now, the question is, let's say that this older vine has an interesting story to tell because it's planted in a great place. And so the few grapes that it gives will give you remarkable juice that has all sorts of the potential to have all kinds of nuance and communicate a great number of things. And because of that, the wine is relatively scarce and the price rises relatively high because people want to hear that story.
Sure.
And so economically, it's reasonable to have those older vines. Sometimes the vines are planted in a place where the story is not so interesting, and when you get less and less grapes and the story doesn't get any more nuanced, it's kind of like, well,
it's not worth it anymore.
It's the difference between like art and commodity.
Sure.
There's a balance there that old vines are sort of the dividing line sometimes on. So, well, public radio serves up all kinds of stories every day, some more appetizing than others, I guess. And listeners like you make it possible. We're in the midst of our Winter Pledge drive, and we hope you'll become a member now. Here's what you need to do. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And Cindy, we're doing the Pledge Drive edition of Food & Wine with Foreman & Wolf.
We are, so please donate.
And thanks to everyone who's called in so far.
Absolutely.
And so we talked about the horrors of planting wine.
It does seem rather difficult after what you just said. So it's good. Like I said, it's just such a commitment, and I admire the people that are committed to it because we're certainly thankful for their end result.
There's no question. I don't know that people all know. Now, you have something that you're ambitious about planting some things on.
Yeah, I'm excited.
On your farmland.
Yeah.
But maybe grapes are a little bit more intimidating.
No, I absolutely want to plant grapes. Actually, that was one of my
very... You're out of your mind.
Oh, I am not. That was absolutely one of my first thoughts when I saw the land. I really feel... And I'm going to ask, we have a local winemaker, Bert Bassignani, who lives not too far from me. And I still haven't. I need to get him over to the property and see if he thinks it's viable. I absolutely want to plant vines, and I'm gonna. We have a fellow that works for us who has a.
Trying to grow wine is like being in the restaurant business. Anyone that wants to do it, I would just say, don't do this to yourself.
Why? No, I'm dying to actually. I really want to. but Sam, who works with us, is a graduate of Cornell's ag department, and. You know, he's super excited to help me with my planting, which I need all the help in the world since I absolutely know nothing about it other than how to cook it. So he's already been out.
People like that you know how to cook it.
Well, that's nice. He's been out to the property, I guess, about 2 weeks ago, and we're deciding whether or not we wanted to actually plant in the ground or do beds, raised beds. And where I live, we have a tremendous amount of rocks in the land. And come to find out just and a lot of stuff going on with the land that I think for us probably the easiest way to get things started since I'm going to do a very small garden in the scheme of things is to do raised beds. So we found a site and he's going to come out and at early morning and late evening probably in the next week to see where the sun really does fall on the land because I have a barn on my property that and sort of a sort of a big treed in area that may affect where we've picked. So he needs to check that out. He's going to do soil samples and all this great stuff. And I've already he threw me some seed catalogs and I made a list that he he seemed very optimistic about. But I have a feeling is me being a dreamer, you know, because that's what I do. So I cannot wait. What a dream for me to walk out of my house in the morning and walk up to the garden and pick what I want to do special for that day at the restaurant. And, you know, the excess, you know, anything that I can't use is going to go to the other properties. I mean, we have so many outlets for it and, you know, I'm not going to grow a lot. Who knows? How it's going to go?
I'll be most curious as the season goes along what actually does come up and what doesn't. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. I know. I'm so excited.
That's like there will be some fails.
Sure.
I mean, there are only a very few gardeners that, and it's only with a lot of experience usually that they can get done an awful lot of things in vegetable gardens successfully first time or two.
Well, he's going to, you know, plant the seeds in the hoop house now. So, you know, I'm very fortunate that he's with us. I really do. I'm so thankful for him and his brother is a chef for us too. So when I said, you know, I don't know if I have time to help you very much with this, and he said, well, I'll just make my brother come out. And I'm like, yes, that's a good use of James's extra time.
That's something I'd say about my younger brother. I would say,
he'll come out and help me.
I still say that, and my brother's 45.
Yeah, right?
I'll make him do this. I'll make him do that. I'm not likely to make him do anything.
I'll certainly help, but, you know, it's obviously a very time-consuming, full-time kind of job thing. So we'll see, but... you know, I'm really excited about the idea of possibly growing hops as well. I know.
Are you drinking beer now?
No, but I know that a local brewery is in need of some hops, so I want to try to grow that to see how we do with it. And I think it's also fascinating how they grow up a pole. So, I mean, it's not going to take up a lot of ground. So you know, give it a try. And I believe that takes a little while.
So pole growing.
Yeah, and I really want to concentrate on beans. You know, I want Crowder peas and lima beans and butter beans and hopefully black-eyed peas and favas for sure and English peas. And then I think I picked 6 or 7 different types of tomatoes.
Maybe one day they will think of you first as a bean specialist.
I love to cook beans, so I just... It would be so fun to really work for. Well, and also I also look forward to the whole thing of having baby lettuces, just, you know, tender lettuces coming up that you can just make a amazing salad with for that day. It's a dream come true. I hope it works out.
How long do you think you buy a rifle to kill the deer that are going to eat your lettuce?
Don't say that. Don't say that. We're going to figure out how to fence the.
I said it.
No, shoot.
That's what, right?
Well, I have rabbits and foxes and turkeys and I have all kinds of animals on my property.
But it's
so,
the deer that are going to go after the lettuce.
Well, we're going to have a fence to keep the deer out, so no worries there. Figure it out.
Deer leap.
No. God. So, and then we'll see about the vines that may be. You know, but as you just pointed out, it takes a while for them, you know, to be viable. So if I do want to plant vineyards, I feel like I need to get on it. And I also want to plant fruit trees. And my farm used to be called Pear Hill Farm. And
What kind of pears are you going
to grow? See, that's the thing. Come to find out they named it Pear Hill Farm because of the shape of the land. that it's shaped like a pear. I know, I was all excited. I'm like, oh my gosh.
That hurts my feelings.
They used to have a lot of pear trees here. So anyway, there are pear trees on the property, apple trees and some fruit-bearing trees. So again, you know, it's all a mystery at this point. And I just bought the property and at the end of October.
Yeah, you know me, I get like romantic feelings about good pears.
Oh my gosh, I love, well, and I love peaches. Well, you know, the first thing I did was plant two peach trees in Roland Park when I bought my house there. I mean, you know, and they produced hundreds of peaches. So if I can do it there, hopefully we can get it done in this beautiful piece of land. So I definitely want to have peach trees and pear trees.
You produced many delicious peaches for squirrels.
I did, unfortunately. Yes, you're right. Those were some fat Roland Park squirrels.
Happy squirrels.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's very cool. That's what we're interested in. When you actually bring the stuff in and get it cleaned up and make, I want to have a salad from the greens that survived the deer and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, stop it.
What?
Yeah. The deer are not going to eat all my food.
I'm not trying to be a naysayer.
Yes, you are.
I'm trying to have a
little
fun.
You're smiling right now.
I'm trying to have a little fun at your expense, but I'm not trying to be a naysayer. I think it's great.
Yeah, sorry.
So what is the number one thing that you want to cook that will come from your land?
Oh, well, I hadn't thought of it because I am so excited about the tomatoes. I think probably the beans, you know, making a great bean salad, you know, maybe doing something with rabbit confit and having fresh fava beans and fresh crowder peas and fresh lettuces from the garden and, you know,
I'm gonna make a
doing
prediction.
A simple vinaigrette, and I'm going to grow a lot of herbs. I've also thought about doing a field of lavender. I mean, first of all, it would be astonishingly beautiful if it worked, and I would love to, you know, have that. So, I love lemon verbena, and I know that's a difficult one to grow in our area, so I'd really like to go heavy on that as well.
So, lemon verbena is ambitious, also.
I know. I hope we can achieve it because, gosh, there's so many things you can do with lemon verbena. One of my favorites is actually a vinaigrette that you made one time a long time ago, and you know, it was just corn oil and lemon verbena.
Well, that's a great compliment for crab meat's delicacy.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, lemon verbena is sort of an odd thing. The leaf actually has little hairs on it, so you really can't eat it. You have
that's
to puree
appetizing.
It.
Yeah.
So you have to puree it or whatever, but you know, my favorite chef in France, Michel Garrard, has fields of it, and you know, they have lemon verbena soap in their hotel, and they use lemon verbena when they wash their sheets. And I mean, everything about the place is, you know, lemon verbena sorbet, lemon verbena this. I mean, I just love it, and I admire him so much. So I'm going to emulate him with this, and hope that we can actually grow some fantastic lemon verbena.
Lemon verbena for the sheets.
Hey, my cousin has like a green thumb and she's raising tons of it up in York. So,
oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it can be done.
I have one prediction, by the way, about
presidential race.
No.
No.
I have.
Yeah, anyway.
That is not a topic
moving
for us.
Very quickly back to.
I don't. The prediction that I have is that you have always preserved a little bit of stuff.
Oh,
this
I'm,
year when you're actually getting it out of the ground.
Oh, I'm going to be. Yes.
I expect that you're all of a sudden going to have a bunch of chow chow.
Oh, definitely.
And a bunch of pickled beans.
I'm going to do a ton of it. Definitely.
Yeah, that's.
I'm excited
I think
about
that,
that.
Once you have that product and the things that come in well are going to come in deeper than you can use.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the old way.
Yeah, for sure.
That whatever it's a good season for, you hang on to those things so you can have them in the wintertime.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that, making preserves and things, pickling.
But I know you had one other question.
Yeah, so with our local farmers, what, you know, since we have a pretty long history with them, you do especially, what do you think we're going to see first and what should people anticipate?
They should anticipate nothing.
And when? Yeah, well, that's the thing.
Here's what actually happens every year, and people get excited.
Prematurely.
They're excited prematurely. Like by the end
of... Well, we can't help it.
By the end of April,
right?
Or by the middle of April... People are losing their minds, and they want new stuff to cook, and people want to see spring menus, and they want to go. That's like warmer out, and they want to go to the market. Well, guess what? The first 2 weeks it's warmer out, it's also the first 2 weeks it's warmer out for plants.
Right.
Nothing is ready, and even if it's been started in hoop houses and all that kind of stuff, it's not its best by far.
Mm-hmm.
What will always come properly and first is asparagus. And asparagus will come between the 22nd and the 27th of April. And it's never even that great until like a week later. When the first crop comes, it's a week later. That's the stuff that you want.
Gosh, I can't wait. That's going to be
so
fun.
And for about 3 weeks, unless the heat spikes too high, too quickly, for about 3 weeks usually, or you get some like crazy, crazy rain. If it's reasonable for 3 weeks, you're going to get the best 3 weeks of asparagus of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll get another week or two that are fine, but they start to get horseradishy.
Okay.
And that first week is just a little bit light on flavor because there's just not that much chlorophyll that's in the plants yet. But you get that sweet spot that is spectacular, and you want to just make a main dish of it or make asparagus risotto for your...
Yes.
You know, I mean, that's there's your great brunch dish, you know, is like have
a... I love asparagus risotto.
It's like put on your buffet an egg dish and, you know, polenta and or, you know, whatever. But
mm-hmm.
whether it's asparagus risotto or just a
I love to make asparagus
simple grilled
soup
asparagus
too.
Or,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah,
that's...
Yeah, great asparagus salad, maybe a little buffalo mozzarella on there or a little bit of boiled egg yolk and egg white, you know,
grilled
finely chopped
grilled
over
asparagus,
top.
Buffalo mozzarella, good extra virgin olive oil.
Tarragon.
No acid except for a tiny little bit of white vinegar and lots of fresh tarragon. Yeah,
asparagus
that's an old
favorite. Like acid. Not too much.
Yeah, it's strong, and even the wines that do well for it, the best of which is almost always Suave Classico. That's a grape that doesn't have a tremendous amount of acidity. It actually has, especially in the young ones, really good polyphenols, and there's a little bit of crunch to it and a little bit of bitterness to it. That's more attractive.
Is Suave Classico one of the best wines or only wine for asparagus, or what else can you suggest?
It can often be mm-hmm. one of the best, and they're great producers of that wine. Sylvaner from the Alto Adige can be really, really good. Dry and clean. Pinot Blanc from Alsace, especially a dry, cleaner style.
Great
can
wines.
Can be terrific. Really fruity stuff is not so nice.
Okay.
Sweet stuff is not so nice. You need a little bit of something almost a little bit bitter. Some Cortese from Piemonte, meaning some good Gavi di Gavi, can be good with. Some rosés that are a little bit firmer, not fruitier style rosés, can be good with. But my warning is that's the end of April. That's not the middle of March.
Right. It's not for Easter.
We've got five or six. No.
Other holidays.
We've got 5 or 6
spring
weeks
holidays.
To go. That's till that stuff happens. We should do a chef's challenge in the last segment. And we should do a chef's challenge that's maybe potentially an Easter meal, don't you think?
I agree.
So, or at least an Easter dish. And, well, we'll take another quick break now. And you can become part of the team that makes public radio possible. Become a member during this winter pledge drive, and here's how. Welcome back to Food and Wine with Foreman and Wolf. It's the Pledge Drive edition. Thanks to everyone who's called in so far. So, Cindy, it's time.
Okay.
Starting the plan for...
Let me have it.
Whether it's Easter or a spring menu. You want your challenge?
I do. I'm going first this time. Okay.
I've written it in my incredibly careful handwriting.
Okay. All right, so two rabbits.
I may be missing a couple of things that
Wait a minute. Why are you maybe making me, Rick, rabbit at Easter for an Easter meal? What's wrong with you?
I love rabbit. It's a good time of year for nice young rabbits. And you can buy, like, excellent chocolate bunnies to serve for dessert.
Oh, my gosh.
Save yourself the step.
Okay, so two rabbits, dandelion greens, day-old bread, dried fruits. Well, I get to pick.
Yeah.
Fresh milled grits. Ooh, acorn squash. Love it. Walnuts. That's funny. I gave you walnuts. Young carrots. One piece. Something. Goat's cheese.
Aged.
Mature. Pomegranates, which are not going to be. Butter, milk, and toasted cumin seeds. Well, okay. I don't like cumin, so I'm not going to use that. Okay.
If it's on there, you got to do
gross,
something
Tony.
With it.
Okay. Actually, I do like cumin, but used very, very, very delicately.
There's an old Teutonic way of using cumin seeds.
The other thing is that I don't... Well, anyway, all right. So with the cumin seeds, I'm just going to use them right off the bat then since you gave them to me. And I have a mortar and pestle that I'm actually very anxious to use at home because I just bought it for my new house. So I'm going to grind the toasted cumin seeds in the mortar and pestle. I'm going to... add a little bit of the dried fruit to the mortar and pestle at the same time and just kind of pulverize it in there with those cumin seeds. And I'm going to take a little bit of corn oil and slowly drizzle it in. So I'm going to say those dried fruits are, do you want to be specific or not? Okay, so apricots. So a little bit of apricots. And I think apricots and cumin would be really actually quite beautiful together. So once I slowly drizzle in the corn oil, I'm just going to make this paste and... I'm going to rub that on the rabbits. So let's get to the rabbits. So I've got to break down the rabbits. Since it's a dinner, and I'll probably will want to use a buffet and do this family style, I'll take the foreleg and the hind leg off the rabbit and cut the saddle out of the middle. So that's the loin. And underneath the loin, you have basically the smallest tenderloins in the world. I mean, they're like 1/4 the size of your pinky finger. They're almost useless. But if you leave them on, there is something, it clings to the bone. So it does actually become something that you can enjoy. The loin has a...
You can enjoy a very, very small
bite. Very small bite. The loin has a bit of silver skin on the top of it. So you need to pull back the membrane that's on the outside, then remove the silver skin. And I'm going to leave the flanks on, the tenders on, which is everything to do with the saddle. And what I'm going to do is put that paste in the center of all of that, and then I'm going to tie it with butcher's twine. And so now I've got this cumin and apricot paste in the center of the animal. I'm going to use a little bit of that day-old bread, too, that you've given me, and put that also in there with it. So it's just going to end up kind of becoming a little bit of a stuffing. So what I'll do with the day-old bread is I will dice it into a medium dice. I'll saute it in a little bit of butter, and then I will put a layer of that. First, I'll rub the cumin and... toasted cumin and apricot business on the outside, on the inside, and then put the bread in and then tie it, roast it. The legs, I am going to confit. I'm not going to confit because I often talk about confiting something. So I'll grill them. I would like to get a new grill. My grill is shot, and so I'm really looking for something that
What'd you do to it?
It just sat outside too long for too many years and rusted away. So it's time for a grill that I can actually put wood on or charcoal or whatever I want to. So I want a multi-use grill, not just a gas-fired unit that has, you know. So that's the kind of grill I'm going to have, and I'm going to smoke those rabbits. So I'm going to put some good wood out there and just put the top on and smoke the rabbit legs and forelegs. The forelegs have almost no meat on them at all. Once those forelegs have smoked a little bit, I'm going to grab them, and I'm going to start to make a sauce with them. And I'll just add a little white wine, a little mirepoix, put those legs in a pot, and so I have some sort of a sauce I can and with rabbit you have almost no gelatin in the bones because the bones are so tiny.
So it's really like a
which
jeu.
Will lend
you can get a
yeah,
jeu
it's gonna be yeah, it's gonna be a jeu. And with that, I have dandelion greens, which I recently bought and were quite tough. So I'm going to actually cook the dandelion greens in that broth. And I'm also going to cook polenta in some of that, you gave me grits. I'm going to cook some of the grits in that broth too. Ooh, and those young carrots are going to be part of the garnish on my rabbit when I go to serve it. I'll peel and leave them in large pieces and roast the young carrots. And when they come out, I'll add the walnuts to that. Meanwhile, I've got the dandelions cooking in a little broth, rabbit broth, and I have my polenta. I keep calling it polenta grits in my broth. I've used the bread, the acorn squash. What do I want to do with that? I think I may roast that. So I'll roast it.
You never want to eat your vegetables.
I know. I'll roast it. I'll hit it with a little bit of butter, just a little bit of cinnamon, a little bit of lemon juice, salt and pepper, and a pinch of sugar, just a tiny bit of sugar, and a little bit of corn oil.
So you're going to split them open.
I'll cut them in half. Right. Cut them in half,
seed
them, season them, roast them flesh side down on a sheet pan with a little bit of water underneath them so they moistly roast. And then I'll pull that meat out, and that will also become my vegetable with my carrots and my walnuts. And I have used everything. So I have my loin, which... when it goes on the buffet, I can actually stand there and slice off the bone, and we can spoon out the stuffing, which will be actually quite delicious. I guess I've decided I like cumin. And and then you have your vegetables that we've talked about, and make a quick little salad. The goat's cheese will love the pomegranates seeds, so just lay out, actually not a salad because you didn't give me any lettuce, so I'll just lay out the goat cheese on the buffet, hit it with a little bit of good extra virgin olive oil, a little bit of roughly cracked black pepper, and then just lay out the seeds on top of the goat cheese, and actually that'll be nice and refreshing. If I did have some herbs or lettuces, I'd probably put mosh or lamb's leaves leaf lettuce out, something tender green, pretty, maybe a little butter lettuce out, and maybe a little mint would be very pretty. And you gave me milk. I'm just going to drink that.
I figured you'd want to cook your grits in it. Enjoy your milk.
Uh-huh. I love milk.
Very nice.
Okay, your turn.
Here we go. Leg of lamb. Okay. Fingerling potatoes, garlic, lamb stock. I conveniently have lamb stock in my freezer. A rosemary, cooking red wine, as opposed to red wine for the cooking. Eggs, walnuts, beets, chioga, red, and baby gold. You gave me a variety of beets. Look at you. That's awesome. Polenta and catfish, in case you wanted catfish with your lamb. Collard greens, rice, mash, black-eyed peas, lemon, parsley. Okay. What I want is a catfish as a first course. I want catfish with the polenta as a first course. And I want to lightly pickle those black-eyed peas and some of those beets to serve as almost like a little chow chow or something with the, or a jardiniera almost as a garnish on the side of the polenta just cooked with milk and butter. And that catfish I'm going to pan fry it, big surprise.
Yep.
I'm going to cornmeal it, and I'm going to dry some of that parsley out. Before I cornmeal it, and some of that dried parsley will be part of what ends up finishing that in the oven as it browns up once it's out of the pan. But there's that dish. So that leaves me rice and all the lamb drama and some potatoes. Okay. With the leg of the lamb, the question is bone, no bone?
Bone in.
So get it out of the fridge, rub it down with the garlic, the rosemary. You want to cut little pockets in some of the flesh around the bone so that you can get seasoning in there. But you want to season it as well as you can. You want to get it up to temperature and get it ready for roasting. And a little bit of lemon. I'd rather have vinegar. I guess you could use a little bit of lemon, a little bit of red wine for rubbing it down along with some oil. But it's really the salt, the rosemary, the garlic that's the important stuff, and get that ready to roast. And that's probably, depending upon the size of it, that's not a convected oven ever. And that's what, probably 325 for a pretty good long while. I'm not a big believer in started high, attempt to get some caramelization on the outside. Just cook it patiently. And as it goes along, lamb's gonna seep a lot of fat. Just baste it with its fat. It will brown. That's not.
Yeah.
It's going to get crispy on the outside, and like a lamb.
I can smell that roasting
right
now.
You got four different muscles, and that's one place I like plenty of garlic actually on that.
Yeah.
You could even kind of sliver some garlic in by the bone to perfume that lamb. It's not so much you want to eat the garlic, but you want the perfume of it.
Right.
And there's so much that's strong flavor for that fat. You keep basting it with the seasoning and the fat as it goes along. Get it to about medium well. Rest it, get it to just about room temperature, and then slice it nice and thin. The remainder of your beets and all that sort of business, and the fingerling potatoes, I would have just boiled off those fingerling potatoes in properly salted water. Get all those things around that same temperature. Reduce that lamb stock, because I would like a little bit of the lamb stock to drizzle on the vegetables as well as the slices of lamb, and a little bit of balsamico for the vegetables as well. I think
that'd
be good fun.
Yeah.
The walnuts and the eggs. You gave me eggs. I didn't have a plan for eggs.
It was because it was Easter. I thought you'd color them.
I could color them, yeah. I could color the eggs. What am I going to do with the eggs? I mean, I could hard boil them and eat them as I go because it's a long time to roast the lamb. Depending upon the size, you got, an hour and a half to...
Sure.
If it's American lamb, they're pretty good size. So,
right.
Yeah, anywhere from an hour and a half to two and a half. The main thing with that sort of thing is just patience and care. The eggs, I will have eaten the eggs for breakfast. I'm sorry, they're not around anymore. The walnuts, honestly, that's the only thing that I remotely have for dessert are the lemon and the walnuts.
And eggs.
I'm not going to do anything with. I told you I ate the eggs for breakfast. The walnuts, I'm going to candy the walnuts. And have those afterwards, and have them with a nice big fat bottle of Madeira. And I think that's the end of my story.
Okay.
Okay.
Very good.
That's about the end of what we have time for. It's WYPR's Winter Pledge Drive. It's nearly done. Thanks for listening to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
So now's the time to do your part on the weekend, become a WYPR member, and here's how.